Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Welcome to spring, everybody. At least in Hungary, where I'm recording from, the snowdrops are a little bit past their glory. The crocuses are still a gaudy carpet, at least as this podcast is being recorded. And to quote the Beatles, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Here comes the sun. That's not the sun. That's the JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann. By the way, please visit https://www.espigan.org knowledge-center to examine the offerings, and don't forget the Helsinki annual meeting, 14th to 17th of May, of Espigan. Your podcast team will be there. Stop by, say hello, and bring chocolate. Jake, your choices for discussion today are from the Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by Irimane et al., who write from the Hospital de Clínicas, Faculty of Medical Sciences, National University of Asunción in San Lorenzo, Paraguay. The article is titled Lactobacillus reuteri Protectus DSM 17938 at high doses versus placebo in children with acute gastroenteritis in a pediatric emergency department. You've also chosen from Science by Grazner et al. Exposure to sugar rationing in the first 1,000 days of life protected against chronic disease. Note that protected rather than protects. It's a retrospective study of sorts? I guess we could say that. There are co-authors on that study in Canada, or North USA, the USA, and Mexico, or South USA. Given that we have the Gulf of America instead of the Gulf of Mexico, I think it's appropriate to rename those countries. What about you?
I mean, go for it. You know, I'm easygoing on these things, and I try not to hold strong opinions on things I know little about.
All right. You folks in Denmark out there listening, Greenland is now officially East USA. That's Dr. Jake Mann who told you. So the JPGN article, it reports study of a commercial probiotic made by BioGaia, Protectus DSM 17938. That contains a patented strain of Lactobacillus reuteri, and this strain was administered to children aged less than 5 years who required emergent care for acute gastroenteritis and who were either mildly or moderately dehydrated. I wasn't able to sort out which kids were treated in hospital and which kids were sent home, but maybe you have a handle on that. Two demographically similar cohorts were assembled, one of which was given placebo, cohort 70 persons, and one given Protectus, cohort 62 persons. Over 5 days, the numbers of stools per day fell more quickly among children given Protectus. Their disorder also resolved more quickly overall, the comparison, of course, being those children given placebo. And the differences in favor of probiotic use reached statistical significance. The authors conclude that the BioGaia product can be useful in clinical settings. Jake, have I summed that up okay?
Yeah, that sounds about right, Alex. I picked this paper partly because it was another one of those things that I thought I knew nothing about, and I wasn't aware that probiotics had efficacy in reducing the duration of acute infectious gastroenteritis. I partly also selected it because initially I was a bit skeptical, and I thought, well, there must be some fundamental methodological flaw in this. But reading through the paper, of course, there's a few bits which are a little bit unclear about who was inpatient, who was outpatient. Other than that, it sounds like a well-conducted placebo-controlled trial. The groups were similar going in. They had a standardized way of randomizing. The placebo was in a very similar formulation to the intervention. And they've got a clear and consistent evidence of efficacy, which they've not done anything particularly complicated in trying to assess it. Simply just number of poos per day, each day after follow-up for 5 days, should be a relatively straightforward metric to assess. They've included a suitable number of individuals. They had calculated on their power calculation they needed about 35, and they've got 62 and 70, so well above what they would need to, and consistent with that, they've got confidence intervals that are in a sensible range and all consistent with an improvement. So overall, it actually seems like a reasonably straightforward and well-conducted RCT from my perspective.
I certainly don't treat on a regular basis children who present to an emergency department with diarrhea and evidence of mild to moderate dehydration. And I had to go reading as well about Lactobacillus reuteri, and I, like you, I was skeptical. I thought, well, isn't this interesting? Is this all New Age medicine, or are there evidences that this is something worthwhile? And I went to the BioGaia website, and there I found at www.biogaiagroup.com /science/clinical-studies, to date, more than 260 clinical studies using BioGaia's human strains of Lactobacillus reuteri have been performed on approximately 22,000 individuals of all ages, with results published in more than 250 articles in scientific journals as of December 2023. What deficiency in our understanding of the use of BioGaia products did this study compensate for, fill up? It seems as though Lactobacillus reuteri has been studied forward and backward for more than 30 years, and efficacy and safety have been demonstrated over and over and over again.
Agreed. And I was also not aware at first that there's been several Cochrane systematic review and meta-analyses on this topic, which the authors sort of refer to, but I don't think they refer to the actual Cochrane systematic reviews. So back in 2010, there was one on probiotics for treating acute infectious diarrhea and a separate one on probiotics for treating persistent diarrhea in children. And there was actually relatively limited evidence for persistent diarrhea, but that isn't really what this trial considers. This is really the acute infectious diarrhea. And at that point, there was, in 2010, 63 studies that met the inclusion criteria, and the conclusion of the Cochrane group was that the probiotics appear to be safe and have clear beneficial effects and shorten the duration. So again, that gives us reassurance that we've seen a consistent result in this RCT with what had been previously described, but does come back to the odd point of just because it can be done doesn't mean it should be done. However, the point to that I would add is that at least the Cochrane systematic review does say there is particular need to understand the protocol regime and in specific patient groups. So I suppose what the gap in the knowledge that this addresses is in this particular context, in this particular group of individuals, this is the magnitude of efficacy. And the authors do state numbers needed to treat, which is a very helpful metric for giving you a bit of a clinical feel for how many patients would we need to give this drug in order to demonstrate the benefit that they've stated, and therefore would help in your actual decision making. Because I think it's a relevant question of if you have a child with a relatively minor self-limiting condition, do you need to give them a drug?
That comes down to my that lets me approach my next question, which is, this is something patented, something studied, something expensive. something for which the pharmaceutical firm can and does charge quite a bit. Apparently, Jake, you don't use this in Birmingham if you cover ER duty. If you cover A&E duty, I'm not sure that you do, because it's not something that's in your personal armamentarium in dealing with kids with such problems. But couldn't the A&E refrigerator simply contain a few pots of yogurt?
I suppose that some form of natural food stuff that contained a high concentration of one of these naturally abundant bacteria or commensal bacteria of the gut would probably have the same efficacy. I suppose it's whether that would really be likely to get into the bellies of these kids, whereas this was formulated where they had to have a couple of drops twice a day for 5 days, which mm-hmm. is probably easier to get into a child of, I think the median age was about 2.5 years old. So I suppose that would be one reason. I guess my newfound skepticism, having now understood the paper, is if we're talking about a reduction in duration of diarrhea from a couple of days, even if there's effectively no adverse effects, is it still needed? Probably the best argument for that would be an economic one, in the sense that on the basis that most schools and nurseries require 48 hours without diarrhea before a child can return to school. And whilst, yes, there's the chance of a child missing school or nursery, but their parents would typically be off work if the child is off. And therefore, if you were saving 1 to 2 days of parental work for every child, if you are able to shorten the duration of infectious diarrhea, then that could actually be a totally reasonable public health level rationale for treating this sort of thing.
Fair enough. And yet many of these kids were simply sent home with the non-labeled black box file and an eyedropper. And you just never know whether or not Mom and Dad said, you know, this is the same thing that's in yogurt. Let's give them some more. Yogurt mixed with applesauce, Jake, I can recommend it. Gets down and in a lot easier. Anyhow, thank you for recommending this paper. It took me into a part of medicine with which I certainly was unfamiliar. Let's move on to the article in Science. Well, in September 1953, sugar rationing ended in Britain. That was when diets went off the sugar cliff. The article describes differences in development of type 2 diabetes mellitus and high blood pressure between those who in utero were exposed to low levels of sugar, that is, those born before rationing ended, and those born thereafter, when, as far as sugar consumption was concerned, it was Katie bar the door. The authors took care in studying the incidence of these disorders to account for and to exclude contributions from shifts in dietary content of fat and of protein. Just reading from the text of the article, the sample included 60,183 participants born between October 1951 and March 1956, aged 51 to 66 when surveyed. The data were drawn from an anonymized biobank run by the British government. Adults conceived in the 1,000 days before September 1953 were classified as rationed and were born between October 1951 to June 1954. 38,155 of them. Adults conceived after were classified as never rationed and were born between July 1954 and March 1956. 22,000 and 28 of them. It sounds as though once candy was available, Britons rather went off sex, doesn't it? But in any event. And further, we found that early life exposure to sugar rationing led to a reduction in T2DM, type 2 diabetes mellitus, and hypertension risk by about 35 and 20%, respectively, and delayed the onset of these diseases by about 4 and 2 years, respectively. The longer the postnatal experience of sugar rationing, that is, the earlier the kids were born, the more slowly these disorders developed. And sugar consumption variability did not seem to affect incidence of other disorders, helping to exclude nonspecific effects. Whoa, well, that certainly sounds as if it's something that should be taken into account in persons who counsel women and men approaching a pregnancy. Cut back on the sugar. Do your child a favor and keep it cut back even after the child is born. Have I got that right?
I think that no one would argue with that advice. And the levels of sugar consumption that were described during the rationing period very much align with current nutritional guidance of maximum daily intake of added or refined sugars. This is one of these interesting studies where the group of researchers have thought very carefully about what was essentially a natural or historically occurring potential experiment. So they call it a quasi-experiment of variation that happened due to circumstances. And there's other examples of these have been reported in the past. So
the famine years in Holland, for example.
Exactly. So where you have, within a relatively short period of time, two groups who had very different intakes. So the rest of the major confounders should be similar in the sense of their general life and the environment and the culture. But they have one stark difference, which is in sugar intake. And the authors do try to acknowledge almost all the other confounders in terms of total other macronutrient intake. And they've demonstrated through a number of other means why they believe this to be the mechanism for the observation that they have seen. I suppose my main caveat with these studies, and I feel like I'm really boring every time I say this, but nutritional epidemiology is really, really hard to do, and it's very easy to be caught out with confounders that are difficult to measure. I'm sure that it's John Ioannidis who said that almost all nutritional epidemiology is wrong, and I know he has his own critics, but it does make a good point that it is. There's so much going on in these individuals that even the most carefully conducted studies can be affected by factors that are difficult to measure.
I'm going to hypothesize an example of that. Jake, what if September 1953... was the date on which television broadcasting became available in Britain?
Then that would be a potential influencer of sedentary activity.
It would be people are having fewer babies because they're watching TV. That's one clear inference, but the other, of course, is that watching TV in the mother or infant has a deleterious effect on rates of diabetes mellitus and hypertension incidence. Blame TV for so much else. Why not blame it for this too?
I think let's drag it down. I like the idea.
Fantastic.
I think that the main one in my mind is that total caloric intake must have changed, and it is hard to see how that is not a major driver. I know that they say, well, overall intake of protein and fat has not changed, but surely total caloric intake changed if sugar intake doubled. Unless people were just sat there eating pure bags of sugar, and even then, that of course would increase your total caloric intake. And starvation or being in a negative energy balance has been persistently shown across all living organisms. It's been studied in to reduce the rates of essentially every chronic disease and prolong life. So I think that's the major confounder here. But either way, it's probably sensible advice to stick to the current recommended intake of sugar during pregnancy and during early life, well, and throughout life. But I'm just a little bit skeptical whether the only mechanism that was observed, the only mechanism for the observation here is the sugar intake.
Well, you can't be too careful. So I think that I'll obtain Dr. Mann's endorsement, in which I say, for those listening at home, at work, wherever you may be, put the lid back on that tin of Quality Street and go have some fresh vegetables.
Sounds like a good piece of advice. Though I have to say the snack table on the office at work is less commonly populated with celery and more often of the Quality Street-esque variety.
Thank you, Jake. Fair enough. And with that, we'll say goodbye for this afternoon.
Thanks a lot, Alex.